Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. In our podcast series, we are going to discuss a range of topics affecting police officers and anyone involved in the criminal justice system. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com.
My name's Deborah Brittstone of 3D Solicitors, and I'm joined today by John Beggs, barrister at Sergeants in Chambers, to discuss commanding police armed operations. This podcast will be split into two parts, with the first one today focusing on key considerations and planning, and the second episode will cover briefings and post-incident procedures. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thank you.
Just starting with the sort of main vulnerabilities, what is the main vulnerability of police commanders in armed operations?
If someone is shot dead, there has to be an Article 2 compliant inquest with a jury. The standard of proof now for homicide conclusions in inquests is civil. That changed a few years ago, perhaps to the surprise of most members of the bar. So having regard to the civil standard of proof, there is a greater risk of a finding of homicide by way of unlawful act or gross negligence manslaughter. Occasionally, an inquest has to be converted into a public inquiry for certain reasons, but whether the shooting is dealt with via an inquest or a public inquiry, generally speaking, the form of inquiry will take place a good number of years after the shooting, which means that in the meantime, the memories of the key witnesses, police and otherwise, will inevitably fray and degrade. Furthermore, the media will start to report on and comment upon the incident, which can have the additional effect of distorting or influencing memories. And the passage of time also tends to have the effect of creating greater opportunities for so-called blue-on-blue enmity, where different units within the police start to criticize each other. And so all of these points, the civil standard, the delay in the process, and the impact of the media, points to the critical importance of strategic firearms commanders and tactical firearms commanders, SFCs and TFCs, keeping very good, accurate, contemporaneous records of all of their key decisions and the rationale for those decisions.
So what are the key considerations when commanding these sorts of operations?
Well, the overriding consideration is to demonstrate that the control and the planning of the operation was designed to minimize to the greatest extent possible recourse to lethal force. And that famous principle emerged from the McCann case, sometimes called Death on the Rock, when a three-person provisional IRA active service unit was shot dead by the SAS on the 6th of March of 1988. And that case, which remains a key overriding authority for this field of business, requires that the court, the reviewing court, will focus not only on the state agents who administered the lethal force, in other words, the SFOs or the AFOs, but also, and increasingly one might say, perhaps even more so, on those who commanded the operation. And recent high-profile public inquiries over the last decade, Azel Rodney, Anthony Granger, Jermaine Baker, and the reports from those inquiries emphasize the importance of those in command taking responsibility for the outcome. So to reiterate, although police officers might think it's the person that pulls the trigger that will be under most scrutiny, of course, that person will be under intense scrutiny. But actually, public inquiries and inquests increasingly spend their time looking at those in command, how they assessed the intelligence, how they assessed the risk, issues such as sustained public protection and its application to the instant case. And they examine with very great care those who commanded and controlled the operation from the very outset to its fatal conclusion.
So what's the benchmark for armed operations?
The benchmark is the College of Policing's APP on armed operations. And the very fact that we have this very sophisticated and well-honed benchmark means that counsel acting for those who are seeking to criticize the command of an armed police operation now have a detailed manual of doctrine against which they can judge the efficacy of the command. What this means in reality is if the SFC or the TFC doesn't appear to show respect for and compliance with the APP, they can, of course, be effectively cross-examined as to why not. And this can, in the hands of skillful counsel for families who have suffered loss, give the impression to the jury of a lack of professionalism or worse on the part of those in command of the operation. So to take the most recent example of a public inquiry's criticisms, in the Jermaine Baker inquiry, led by His Honour Judge Goldstone, KC, the judge was highly critical of the failures by senior commanders to comply with the APP. And indeed, he gave many examples of what he found to be non-compliance or breach of the APP. And those occupying the roles of SFC, TFC, and indeed Operational Firearms Commander, OFC, would do well to read His Honour Judge Goldstone's report, which is readily available online and is very easy to follow and to understand.
So the planning stage, what are the key points?
The key issues in the course of planning any such potentially armed operation are for the commanders to assess the state of the intelligence available to them and the operational objective or objectives. So if the objective is sustained public protection, that often means that those in command are going to allow the operation to run so as to capture the greatest amount of potential evidence of the conspiracy on the part of those who are the targets. In other words, sustained public protection will militate against a simple disruption of the criminal entity, but with the concept of sustained public protection comes the requirement of very careful analysis to ensure that what the police are intending to do will indeed maximize public protection rather than do so in what might be an illusory way. So in the Jermaine Baker public inquiry, the judge was skeptical as to whether those in command had truly applied their mind to the question of what impact their intervention, which he regarded as dangerous, would actually have on the relevant organised crime group. So the duty on the commanders is to identify, first of all, precisely what intelligence is available to them, and secondly, to identify the risks which are revealed by that intelligence. And then thirdly, to identify why their particular intervention with a particular tactic at a particular time is likely to maximize public safety, not just at the point of intervention, but because it's more likely to produce cogent evidence enabling the prosecution of the relevant criminals. To take a very well remembered example, in the McCann decision, the Gibraltar Rock decision, the European Court, by the majority, was critical of the United Kingdom authorities for not taking this active service unit out at the Gibraltarian border. And in the Granger public inquiry, the judge was critical of Greater Manchester Police's use of off-the-shelf intelligence packages, which failed to review the intelligence from an up-to-date and up-to-the-minute perspective. So one golden rule, perhaps, that emerges from those cases and from the APP more generally, is that those in command of armed operations should constantly be asking themselves this question: what more can I reasonably do to improve the intelligence picture? And if there is more that could reasonably be done or could have been done, then it should be done, because otherwise the inquest or the public inquiry is likely to ask the penetrating question, well, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you improve the intelligence picture? And so those in command need to keep in mind the inevitable need to demonstrate to the inquest or the inquiry that they were constantly seeking to improve the intelligence picture, and thus their analysis of the best tactical options available to them.
And what can you say about the police use of intelligence?
Unfortunately, if one were to review many police shootings over the last 10, 15, 20 years, the unhappy fact is that time and again, the intelligence relied on by the police has been found either to be inaccurate or sometimes exaggerated. That there's a number of different reasons for this. Often the inaccuracy flows from one piece of intelligence being passed through three or four different people. Sometimes each person puts their own spin on it. Sometimes I'm afraid the inaccuracies are nothing more complex than people mistranscribing the original material. But as I indicated, in addition to inaccuracy, there is a tendency in policing to exaggerate the intelligence, to make the targets look more dangerous than they really are. This then gets transmitted to those in the operation who are charged with effecting the intervention or the extraction. And of course, if you brief the SFOs on the most hysterical or the most dangerous premise, it's hardly surprising, to use the vernacular, that they might be trigger happy, because of course they are being given the worst possible analysis of the targets. And this tendency to exaggeration was noted by the judge on the Azelle Rodney case, and in the Anthony Granger case, and in the Jermaine Baker case, and was also a feature of a civil claim in the High Court called Davis against the Metropolitan Police. In short, the tendency to exaggerate leads to the armed officers being briefed on an overhyped basis, or to use a well-known phrase, sexing up of the intelligence. And this, as I've indicated, has been a constant refrain of public inquiries. What this means is that those in command must be confident in challenging the intelligence package as to its accuracy, its reasonableness, its currency, its conclusions. They must be confident in requiring their subordinates to go back to the intelligence original sources, to double check them, if necessary, to engage in tasking of those who can go out into the field and find further refining intelligence. And it is not an exaggeration to say that overhyped or inaccurate intelligence packages provided to the SFOs could easily lead to those in command of armed operations being considered for criminal prosecution, and if not criminal prosecution, certainly for gross misconduct. And this should not be discounted. This is a real and present risk.
Thank you, John. That finishes this episode of the podcast. We'll obviously be talking about the briefing and post-incident procedure in the next episode. So we'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Plod podcast, Police Law on Demand, brought to you by 3D solicitors and barristers from Sergeants in Chambers. For more updates on police law, follow the Sergeants in Police Law blog at ukpolicelawblog.com. If you have any suggestions for any topics that you would like us to cover, please email plod@3d-solicitors.com.